7 bright stars hang in the night sky, just above the horizon. Glittering balls of blue light. These are the 7 sisters. But all is not right. They drop down onto the earth, pursued by an evil man who chases them across the land and eventually back into the night sky. Today on What's Your Map, we're delving into the world of origin stories and how we map them. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian, and welcome to What's Your Map, an Oculi Mundi exploration. In Season 2, we continue to speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us the story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. Every society has a creation story, whether that's the Book of Genesis in the Christian West or the belief that life originates from a cosmic egg in China. Our guest today, Professor Margot Neal, is an expert in the creation myths of Indigenous Australians, having curated the award-winning exhibition Songlines, Tracking the 7 Sisters, alongside a team of First Australians. The exhibition has made its way across the world. When she isn't busy organising exhibitions, Margot is an adjunct professor at the Australian National University's Australian Centre for Indigenous History and has published 12 books, including The Oxford Companion to Aboriginal Art and Culture. We're so happy to have you join us all the way from Australia, Margot. We're breaking tradition a bit. Tell me, where are you joining us from today?
Oh, that's good. Yes, I'm in Ngunnawal country in what is otherwise known as Canberra, which in fact is aberration of Cambri or Ngambri, which is also another name that's used for this place, another Aboriginal name for the custodians. But normally I'd be in the bush, I came in from the bush to be here. So I came in from Yuin country to be in the capital, national capital. Yeah.
You tell me about the bush in a minute, because I want to just ask you first of all, really, what is the, I guess we'd usually say, what's your map that you've brought in? But I guess with what we're going to talk about with you, we might want to stretch even that conception in the West of what we call a map. So tell me, what is it that we're going to be looking at that you're going to talk to us about today?
Well, my map is actually not a cartographic, topographic one that the Western world would consider a map, but my map is a painting, because a painting in our culture is a map in terms of in multiple levels, like ancestral map, spiritual map, medical map, astronomical map, and it maps multiple layers from, you know, above to below.
What's the map that you brought in today?
Well, the map I've brought in today is a wonderful big round painting. It's red and vibrating, full of graphic symbols that wend and wind around the painting as it shows the journey of 7 sisters. It's a highly textured, dynamic surface, and it's called Kunkaraukapa, 7 Sisters, 2015. And it is painted by 5 sisters, Junkara Ken, Yarachi Young, Marinka Tunkan, Frieda Brady, and Sandra Ken, who work out of an art centre called Jala Arts in the top of South Australia, at the tri-state border near Uluru.
I think what you're describing is an immensely complex and fantastic map that probably goes beyond what the West would understand as a map. Do you think that's fair?
Oh, totally. Maps are quite an inadequate term, even though, as you say, it's more composite than that. It's a space and time and so on. But in this case, it's also a whole world view, and it's a whole knowledge system. Now, remember, we're talking about First Australians, Aboriginal culture that has no text, right? It's a non-text-based society. So clearly it's an oral society. All knowledge and cultural values are transmitted, you know, orally, visually, performatively. And so a map is part of that mix. So, you know, people perform what they see on the paintings that they've put on from the performances. So as you say, it's still graphic, but it operates at multiple levels beyond which really a Western mind or even our minds of today can comprehend.
So take me into this map, painting, cosmology. It's a beautiful object, but I think that that's only really the start of the story. Mm. Can you tell me a bit about what it represents, Margot?
It's representing a really epic saga. And you introduced your saying, you know, that all civilizations have great, you know, like epic sagas and stories of creation and so on. Well, this is the Seven Sisters' song lines, and they're called Kunkurakupa. Say after me.
Give me that again.
Kunkurakupa.
Give me that again.
Okay. Kunkurakupa.
Kunkurakupa.
Oh, pretty good.
Thank you.
But you won't be able to say it in a few minutes' time. Yeah. But anyway, so all of the stories are metaphors or vehicles to convey, you know, origin stories and cultural values, right? So the Seven Sisters starts like this. There's a sorcerer figure who's a lustful pursuer, who's a shapeshifter, so can shift into a being a man, behave like a man, look like a man, and he is also a sorcerer, and he desires these women, wrongfully desires these women according to the kinship and marriage rules of the society. So he wrongfully pursues them all across the country, on up into the Orion and Pleiades there. So he pursues the sisters, and everywhere, all the encounters that occur on the way at all these sites are represented visually in the construction of the site, the colour of the site, the, you know, whether it's a cascade of rocks or a waterhole or a tree, they're all part of the story. So what happens is the sisters, as they're travelling, leave parts of their story behind in all these sites, so all the natural features.
So many cultures have these similar stories about travel, pursuit, danger. It's often very gendered. So this is seven sisters pursued by a shape-shifting, predominantly male figure, and the process of exploration and discovery that you go through, both physical and existential. And I guess that's some element of what's going on here, and that's shown in the, I'm going to call it a map painting.
Yes.
And looking at this, both very beautiful, but then also you start to see the details. So just dig into it, because you can see the seven sisters or a representation of them, can't you? They're there in the top right-hand corner. Is that right, that you see these? There's a group of three and then another little group of white roundels in the top right-hand corner.
Yes.
Just walk me through it, Margot.
In terms of the picture itself, as you said, there's all those roundels at the top which represent the seven sisters. That's the tiny ones. And then this particular part of the sequence of this story starts at a place called Iarka, I-A-R-K-A, and it's a big salt pan, and which is otherwise known as Curtain Springs, and is right out for your listeners out in the red heart of the desert, and has huge rock formations around that look like little Ayers rocks or little Uluru. So the Seven Sisters were sitting there waiting around, and then, of course, Wadi Nyiru, or the lustful pursuer, we'll call him, you know, was approaching, and so they sort of took off, and you can see their journey to the edge of the painting. One of those two rock holes, one of them's called Witabula, and when he was getting, they had a hard day being chased and pursued and hunting and gathering, and what they actually did is, where they had a swim, having a little refresh in Witabula, and there he was. They sighted him coming over the sand dune, and they had nowhere to escape to. So they dived underground. And when they dived underground, you see all those sort of channels, streams of lines.
Is that down to the right, curving round towards the leaves?
Yeah. So that's sort of, a lot of these things are multifunctional. So they also represent, when they dived down, they went into the arterial water systems below the ground. And so What that means is if you're in that country and you need water and you don't know this story, you won't know how to find water because it's not on the surface much, especially in a droughty season. So they go down this underground water stream. They come up at a place called Iroabor and find he's not around. So have a sigh of relief and set about sort of resting, sleeping, hunting, and so on. And on route, they find these leaves. You see those three leaves on the side?
Yeah, this is the bush medicine.
Imankurumankur it's called.
Yeah.
And it's a rubbing for sore parts. Don't forget, they're running forever, being chased, so they probably have a great need for these. But the big story really is when they get to what's called Cave Hill or Walinga. Now, it's quite discreet. It's at the bottom.
Yeah.
Actually, the middle. Yeah, like number six on the clock, 6 o'clock or at the bottom there.
Yeah, it's just to the right. So these wavy, the wavy lines that curve up and then go around. Yeah. Yeah, I see it.
Now, that's an interesting place. When they got there, they were he was in hot pursuit. They got to this shelter. It's a bit like the little piggy story. They built a shelter, but then, it was the wind could blow it down and they got scared, so they ran into this rock shelter. When they ran in there, they were sort of safe, and he decided, his name's Wadi Nyiru here, he decided that they couldn't get out, so he just had to be patient. So he'll just wait and wait and wait. But the sexual side of him, his rational side said, just wait. The sexual side of him said, nah, I can't wait anymore. I'll bugger this for a joke. I'm out of here. So he's what the old men were calling it, his special friend, which we may call his member, actually enlarged and took off, couldn't wait, right? So went into the cave in search of the sisters, and you go in the cave, you see all the winding marks in the rock, you see parts that are women's parts, you see all sorts of stuff, and then they weren't there. There was, and at the back of the cave, I've been into this place many times, there's a tiny opening where they took off. This tracing, advancing interactions occur, and the landscape will show, you'll see these lines, you'll see these circles, you'll see where an incident occurred. It's all in the land, so you read it in the marks of the land.
Yeah.
Then you get up to a place called Kurala. Kurala's right at the top.
Yeah, that's about 11 to 12 o'clock,
Kurala, yes. And Kurala means eyes wide open. And there's a rock over huge, like 20 metre high escarpment that looks exactly like a face, right? Two eyes, a nose.
Yeah.
You might have seen it in the catalogue if you got hold of it.
Yes, extraordinary,
Extraordinary. And, he is there, he is present. And when we're there, the women speak softly as not to rouse him and so on, right? Now, the point of all this is all this story, all this sort of chasing and so on is basically to teach about gender relations, right marriages, wrong marriages, the consequences of not doing it the right way, the way the elder sisters are supposed to care for each other, and the older sister of this group are there to teach the younger ones about risk, not only of a sexual variety, but of the terrain, of the drought, or where the water is, where the best food is, how to survive. There's certain areas of the land where they fly and not because they want to feel the wind in their hair, they fly, which basically says don't even try and walk this 100 kilometres because there's no water, right? So every bit of the story has critical information for, location of resources and for appropriate behaviours.
So this is extraordinary because the idea is that you can actually inhabit and understand country, but you also moralize the stories. So the seven sisters tell you stories about really, I guess they're about how you grow and develop as women and men. Does the male figure, I mean, he's a shapeshifter, but is there a strong sort of gender dimension here about how men should behave and then also how women should behave?
Yes, there is. the thing about Aboriginal, traditional Aboriginal society is a very gendered society. The land, the country is also very gendered. There's women's sites, men's sites, and males. Only the males can look after those sites. When I say look after it, I mean not only physically, spiritually, pay homage to the creator of those sites and so on, right? And same for the men, like in this case, you've heard men's business, women's business,
yeah.
You may or may not. So it is, it's saying to men, you know which moiety or clan group you can marry into, you know which you can't. And this old man who was chasing women who were not in the right group for him to marry. So everything has a purpose. It's not just a fanciful story any more than, you know, other creation sagas.
Before we continue, I just wanted to say that I'm so pleased you're able to join me on my journey into the world of maps, their stories, and the people who love them. If you're enjoying our podcast and don't want to miss a future episode, then please do consider subscribing and leaving a review when you finish listening. And if you think your friends and family might be missing out, why not ask them to give us a listen too? Back to the rest of the episode. What are these song lines? We know the phrase, or many people will, from the Bruce Chatwin book. Just give me your sense of how we should understand and think about what you mean when you talk about song lines and how it connects to this idea of Aboriginal dream time.
Song lines are, in fact, a knowledge system. And they can be visualised as pathways or corridors of knowledge that sort of crisscross the continent, linking all these important sites together. Now, different parts of the country or these songlines are owned by different sets of people. They like a baton, a relay, right? They don't even know what happened to the Seven Sisters over in the NPY lands. And the idea is it's their response. They all have certain inherited rights to parts of the story which they then have to maintain and keep alive and so on. But going back to songlines, there's a fabulous map by an old fella called David Mondrali, and it's just crisscross with lines all over it, and at the intersections of the lines are all these sort of communities or secrets or sites. It may well be in there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a fusion between a Western idea of a map and a painting. For him, it's a painting to explain to white fellas what the song lines sort of look like in a map.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I mean, it looks like a sort of lattice, which is just covering the country, called the body of Australia, Corpus Australis.
Yeah, because don't forget, country is a personage. It's a living being, right? It's not, it's as you see on that map, the pubic, the areas at the bottom, the navel's in the middle, the shoulders are at the top of the country, there's ribs. So the whole, you hear this, you know, the more the cliche of Mother Earth. Mm. We mourn for country, cry for country. If you don't go out to country, which is like your ancestor, your relative, the parts of it that you have inherited, if you don't, you know, pay homage and look after it in multiple ways, it will die, it will close up, it'll get broken. And then your life will also be broken. All your knowledge, it's like all of these sites where encounters occurred. There's many other song lines. Seven Sisters is one, but there's many others, Wallaby ones, all sorts. So when you go to that site or walk, as you learn by walking country from site to site. It's like going from library to library. Mm. You go there, you learn stuff because it's a mnemonic. You know, that shape there, that line there, that waterhole there, that all of these are part of what happened to what sort of story happened there that you can learn a lesson from, right? So then you also deposit knowledge yourself because it's an embodied knowledge system, right?
Is this what you call it, the third archive?
The third archive is, say, an exhibition because it's using the master archive from Aboriginal people in a Western format called an exhibition. Yep. So creates a third archive. Mm. Yeah. Do you get it?
I do. I just thought that was so interesting because as somebody who works in archives, you know, I work in the 15th and 16th century, I just think it's such a powerful way of thinking about how you manage memory, you sustain memory and you take it forward, because there's such a question about how you store things. I mean, of course, one of the big issues here, say in the UK, is how you store archives digitally and you keep memory going. And people are, of course, getting rid of paper archives. So I just found it a very powerful way of thinking about how you archive, what an archive is and what you do with it, and how it sustains memory, I guess, because some of the things you talk about in Songlines is the way in which you've been working with members of the Aboriginal community, saying the songlines are getting broken, and this is an attempt to sort of keep, sustain that story because of how important it is.
Well, the other third archive aspect is that on this particular response to a request that our songlines are all broken up and we want you to help us put them back together, we're the last of the old people who know this story as intimately as this. We know all that country. And our young people are not interested. They're too into hip hop and, you know, all that other new lifestyle stuff. But when they grow up and get married up and stuff, their identity as part of these, you know, inheritance is part of these sites. That's the only way they're going to know who they are. Mm. And so what they did is they asked us to digitize it. So we went on all these song lines and it was recorded in Western systems. They would read the land, perform the songs, do the interviews, paint the pictures, and all of this would then be recorded in various ways and be then deposited in an Aboriginal archive called Ara Eretitia, and it's an Aboriginal managed archive. Now, being an archivist, you'll understand that an Aboriginal archive of this knowledge is not a democratic archive. Mm. So only the people who have a bloodline relationship have access to those stories that they inherited a right to.
Tell me a bit more about that, because I was really fascinated reading your book about this, that there's very specific lines of inheritance because of the importance of keeping the stories, as it were, clear and not diluted. So it's a version of trying to not get into a Chinese whispers story, I guess, because you want to maintain a very precise understanding of creation myths like the Seven Sisters. Just tell me a little bit more about how that is handed down, because that's an intriguing story. As you say, it's not democratic. Archives are often not very democratic. They can't be.
No, but they're much more than this. I mean, it's quite a... almost a crime punishable by God knows what, if in fact the wrong stories that belong to certain men or women, and particularly gender-based stories, are passed on to A, the other sex, and people who have no right to knowledge of no right to the access. So they're very carefully guarded by certain people, and that part of that's to do with maintaining them and keep them alive. They're a treasure. You know, they're only for you, and then you pass it on. They're not, if they belong to everybody, who's going to take responsibility?
How many songlines are there approximately? I mean, you were saying that there are many different elements of the songlines. I mean, can we approximate the number?
No. It would change over time, but there are considered to be five major, like, epic national-wide ones. There's Malu, the kangaroo, and there's about five. And then there's a whole heap of others that are just local, so that if you, for example, the wallaby songline is local and regional, and it helps you to find the wallabies to, you know, work on increase, look after the land so the wallabies thrive. And so there's all the knowledge around. And they also have adventures, you know. So they warn you of what to do and not to do, and when to hunt and not to hunt, and you know, all of that. There's hundreds of those.
Let's talk about you and.
Do we have to?
Yes, we do.
Well, okay.
Because you write interestingly about your relationship to those creation myths when you were growing up. And I wondered if you could tell me a bit more about that and how important were they for you?
I lived, you know, as you know, the southeast part of Australia is most, bore the brunt of colonisation. And there's all these things about your children being separated from your children, not allowed black and white to marry, You know, you can't vote, you weren't, all of this, right, was going on. So my my mother, who's married to an Irish man from the RAF, we lived in a, you know, on the RAF base, and then we lived in town. And, you know, she was very cautious about letting anyone know we were Aboriginal. You know, we'd get, you know, Italian or Greek or whatever other exotica, but you, she was like, we weren't to talk to the neighbours. And my grandmother, who was discernibly dark, would pretty well arrive, visit us from along from hours away by after dark. Now, I didn't sort of put all that together then, and I didn't know any different, so it wasn't upsetting because I didn't know any different. And I thought my nickname was Abbo, which is the most demeaning term, but, you know, I didn't know any different. So, and my mother had been separated, so she was, you know, cautious about her children. So there was no sort of, not like now where you being Aboriginal is an honour and a badge, and you know, it was in your family, but not kind of, you didn't run around shouting it out.
But also then that must have been a struggle in terms of, you talk about being from a poor family, you didn't have much of a sort of artistic heritage really, and yet you broke into the art world. I mean, very successfully. Yeah. Tell me how that happened.
The whole family, we all painted and drew, and we didn't have TV or books even, so that's what we did. We drew pictures, and my grandmother would visit and tell us Aboriginal stories and about our totems and various things. So not that we drew about them only, we just drew and painted about, as kids do, about what's in their lives. So we weren't living in an Aboriginal community. So we weren't subject to all of that, but we just drew and painted all the time. And when I was about 15 and 16, had to get some money to start saving for a car, I was selling paintings to Woodside, you know, the oil companies, and I do oil rigs and portraits of people's houses and faces. And then I went into a business of teaching art, became an art teacher and art curator and art writer and so on.
So was there a distinction there between this kind of work that we've been looking at and it sounds like you were doing quite realistic, you might say Western art, but then how did you then engage with the sort of songlines work that we're talking about here?
Well, you know, I don't actually think there were any known or publicly known Aboriginal artists in Victoria, where I grew up, right, or in those southern states. If they were, they painted in a Western style, or they'd never sell, because at this point in that part of the continent, they believed there were no Aboriginal people, and if there were, it was the white in them that made them okay, not the black in them. So, you know, it was that kind of, I mean, I didn't know that at the time, so, you know, it's only now. So any artist of Aboriginal heritage was doing in a Western style, because we weren't living on country, speaking language, doing ceremony as the people in these pictures were.
You were saying at the top of the program we started speaking about the power of the bush, and you said it's great. Give me a sense of that. What is the beauty of that reconnection with the bush for you?
Yeah. Well, we live half of the week out on Yuin country, which is about an hour a bit from Canberra, and it's got a river and escarpment and bush and birds and wombats and, you know, everything that creeps and crawls. There's snakes, but we haven't seen them. Beautiful, fresh running river. And we have, you know, it's all, our house is all open, a bit like living in a humpy, but a very 21st century humpy, you know, very exposed to the elements and all off the grid and so on. And we have our mob come there, and we do our smoking ceremonies. We have a special kind of area where we do that, and the kids learn to paint bodies, and we have dreaming tracks. So the children mostly learn the wombat dreaming track and various other dreaming tracks. So we put into practice in a contemporary way and dynamic. Our culture is dynamic. That's why we survived. And so we can reclaim and reuse a lot of those things. So Yeah, and there's a the UN. It's a UN country, and they come. Some of the mob there come and join us. So it's, you know, it's very much a reconnection.
What is a mob for you?
The mob is your people, like your clan group, your family.
Yes.
Or sometimes you say it as the mobs, which is you mean Aboriginal people. But if I talk about our mob come to our place and we do soaking ceremonies, and I'm talking mostly about our family group and related peoples.
Got it.
But not only.
Margot, Neil, thank you very much for joining me on What's Your Map. It's been a real, real pleasure. You can get back to the bush now.
Okay. Thank you so much, Jerry. I mean, I can't believe you can get your head around this stuff. You must be a bright man.
Oh, just an interested man. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland collection and send us suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com. Why not continue your journey with me by subscribing to this podcast? That way you'll never miss an episode.